from the Venetian Pool of Coral Gables to the maritime life-saving stations of Jupiter, centennials are busting out all over South Florida in 2025 and 2026. Welcome to a special holiday edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at WLRN's fascinating series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida. Its reports take us back to the epic real estate boom of the 1920s, which spawned city charters up and down our coast. The stories are captivating. Was Al Capone a founding father of Deerfield Beach? Why did all those pink flamingos stay in Hialeah? And how did Boca Raton become a reverse north-to-south black migration magnet? All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bemvindo. We hope you're enjoying the holidays, and because it is the holidays, we wanted to devote this program to a look at the fascinating series WLRN has been airing called History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida. Its reports take us back to this region's epic real estate boom of the 1920s, a land rush that spawned city charters up and down our coast, from Coral Gables to Jupiter. As a result, we celebrated a slew of local centennials in 2025 and we're hailing more in 2026. The stories behind those foundings are engaging and inspiring. Did you know Bahamians built Coral Gables' iconic Venetian Pool? Or that Jupiter played a key role in the Spanish-American War? Do you know how Hialeah and pink flamingos became synonymous? Or how Boca Raton's historic Pearl City neighborhood sparked a black migration wave not from south to north, but from north to south? Embracing these histories is critical for this corner of America, which too often feels as though it has no history. I'm joined now by WLRN's government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos, who headed the History We Call Home series. Josh, how are you?
I'm doing great, Tim.
And in a minute, Josh and I will be joined by WLRN's afternoon anchor, Helen Acevedo, and senior producer, Sherilyn Cabrera, to discuss their Hialeah histories and all those pink flamingos. Josh, let's remind folks that between 1920 and 1925, the populations of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties doubled or even tripled. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we so often cite the real estate boom, but I think a lot of South Floridians aren't aware of some of the key causes of that boom, one of which, as you point out in the first installment of History We Call Home, was the role of soldiers in World War I, right? Tell us about that and some of the other big reasons for this stunning growth at that period.
That's right. So during World War I, the U.S. really needed to ship out agricultural products, food, to help the war effort, sending these over to, you know, the front lines over in Europe. And so it needed a place to grow those fruits and vegetables and all those staple goods. And South Florida
year round.
Yeah. So South Florida was a perfect place because, you know, it's always sunny here. The ground is fertile. So they started building all of these military bases down here where they could build this agriculture. After the war was over, many of these soldiers who were stationed here were like, well, this is actually a great place to settle down. Mm-hmm. And now I can settle down, and there are these, a lot of young soldiers at the time were creating families here. That mixed, I think, with the railroad, as we'll get into later with Henry Flagler, right, along with the expansion of roads and highways and the proliferation of the automobile. All of these things made it so that people could move across the country, and there was great wealth at this time, obviously before the Great Depression, where there was, you know, the Roaring Twenties.
Roaring Twenties, the jazz age, yeah.
And so folks had more disposable income that they could use to buy property. They were looking for places to homestead, and this was the spot.
And that, of course, led to the creation of a dozen South Florida cities almost overnight, as your report emphasizes. What were these new cities, and how did they all get chartered so quickly?
Yeah, so there's a dozen cities in Miami-Dade County. There's Hialeah and Coral Gables, and in Palm Beach County, we've got Jupiter and Boca Raton. And all of these cities were popping up seemingly overnight between this period of 1925 and 1926, which is actually towards the end of the Great Florida Land Boom, which everyone sees the closing chapter of that land boom being the Great Hurricane of 1926, although some historians believe it was already ending by that time. Mm-hmm. And they were able to charter so quick because of so much real estate investment. And in a lot of these cities, you had these wealthy entrepreneurs who were landowners, and they would bring in people from the north to come in and survey their land and buy a property.
That's interesting. Chartering then facilitated more real estate purchasing.
Right. It's kind of
a reason why a lot of villages and cities charter themselves today in South Florida.
Right. So it's sort of a loop where it started with unchartered land that these moguls were bringing in people to buy up land. And then those people would get together and charter a town, charter a village, charter a city.
Yeah.
And then it would grow and grow and grow from there.
Now, here's some interesting city promotional ads you found in your reporting. Let's take a quick listen.
Coral Gables, a name later given to the city itself by son George when he founded it in 1925.
Welcome to Florida's Hollywood, founded in the 1920s to be a dream city by the sea.
So Boca, 100 years coming up, right?
So Josh, why then a century later did you and WLRN feel it was important to explore what I guess we could call the origin story of South Florida? Why is history we call home a project that you especially felt compelled to take on as a journalist?
Yes, look, I was born and raised in South Florida in Miami-Dade County, and I never really learned local history in school. That was not something that was ever taught.
Good point, yeah.
We learned about national and international history, but I didn't know about the city that I went to school in and how it was started 100 years ago by Glenn Curtis. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any of these things, and I think it was around 2020 in the pandemic that I felt I needed to connect more with my history and with my local history. So I started to learn and get into that. And it was last year that I started to notice, along with some of my colleagues, that there were so many cities turning 100. And we saw this as a perfect opportunity to highlight this. And we felt like WLRN was the outlet that needed to be doing this to celebrate our community.
I agree. And now that the series has been airing for almost a year, what sort of results are you and WLRN seeing in terms of local reaction to history that, let's face it, a notoriously transient population like South Florida's probably wasn't all that aware of?
Yeah, we've witnessed a great reaction. We've had the opportunity to be on the Miami History podcast. We partnered with History Miami Museum to be part of their Boomtown series. We've also been working with the Miami-Dade County Heritage Trust in part of their historic preservation magazine publishing. We're going to be doing some work with them. So we've really seen an outpouring of support for this because I think people recognize the importance of local history and educating people. And listen, I like to joke, my friends as well, they all were born and raised here in South Florida, and they don't know anything. They don't know anything about South Florida, what city they're in or anything. And so this is my way of sharing my love for local history with everybody. And I think there's been a really great outpouring of support for
that. It's great that it's resonating that way. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Joshua Ceballos and his colleagues here who've reported our series History We Call Home on the raft of city centennials we're celebrating across South Florida. And right now, I want to bring in two of those WLRN colleagues, the station's afternoon anchor, Helen Acevedo, and senior producer, Sherilyn Cabrera, to talk with us about their engaging reports on the centennial history of Miami-Dade County's second largest city, Hialeah. Helen, Sherry, how are you?
Doing good. Hi, Tim.
Sherry, let's start with the horse racing track and the pink flamingos, which you report were brought here in part to, well, make the French jealous. Tell us that story and how the track and the birds would go on to draw celebrity visitors here like Winston Churchill.
Yeah, so this all goes back to 1930 when a man named Joseph Widener, this really wealthy horse breeder who had just bought and rebuilt the racetrack after it was completely destroyed by the Great Miami Hurricane of 1926. So he had traveled all over the world and was especially inspired by the Longchamp racecourse. So this gorgeous racecourse in Paris that everyone said was the most beautiful in the world. But Widener, he wanted to take things a step further. He came up with this wild idea to bring in pink flamingos. And so he built a habitat for them, literally right in the middle of the racetrack, and shipped in about 20 flamingos from Cuba in 1934.
Oh, that's where they're from. Okay.
Yes.
Cool. Well,
now, the funny part is, by the next morning, the birds had all flown away, and they forgot to clip their wings. But Widener tried again a few years later. This time they clipped their wings, and eventually the flamingos started nesting and raising babies right there on the track. Over time, the flamingos just stayed, and there was no need to clip their wings anymore. But the flamingos ended up being a huge attraction. The combination of elegant horse racing, and then you add in these bright pink birds. Mm-hmm. Hialeah Park was the place to be. Thousands of people would show up, and even big names like Winston Churchill came by in 1946.
And were these also the flamingos we see in the opening credits of the Miami Vice television show?
Yep, exactly. Yep, those flamingos.
I thought so.
And Sherry, you report that even though the track had its last race a quarter century ago, the flamingos are still remaining there. You spoke to someone who used to work at the track and is now a local historian, right?
Yes, exactly. So even though Hialeah Park hasn't seen a horse race since 2001, the flamingos never left. They've really become the heart of the place. There are still close to 100 of them living there in the middle of the old track, and they continue to nest just like they have for generations now. And one of the people keeping that legacy alive is Ken Wild. He's from neighboring Miami Springs, and he actually worked at the racetrack back in the 1960s. He patched roofs, trimmed palm trees. He did all kinds of maintenance work there. But today he's the town's historian, and he still visits very regularly, almost every month. He will just go and sit in the empty grandstand and quietly admire the birds. And the old racetrack is now Hialeah Park Casino, but the core of the property, the grandstand, the clubhouse, the paddock, is historically protected. That means even as new apartments and a charter school rise on the surrounding grounds, the heart of the park stays intact. So for Wild, that balance between change and preservation means everything to him. He told us that the place is full of memories for him, great memories. He even told us that when his time comes, some of his ashes will rest there among the hundreds of others that he says are already scattered on the grounds. So even without the races, Hialeah Park and its flamingos are still very much alive.
And let's just quickly let the flamingos have their say in this discussion, or as they said in your report.
So Helen Acevedo, I want to shift here to your Hialeah focus, because while today we think of Hialeah as a Cuban enclave, your report points out that the city is home to one of South Florida's most important Black enclaves, Seminola. Tell us about Seminola.
Yeah, that's right. So Seminola is a small neighborhood in Hialeah. It's actually the city's only historically Black neighborhood, and it's actually older than the city itself. Seminola was established in 1924 for Black workers who were hired to build and maintain places like the Hialeah Park racetrack and other landmarks like Hialeah's first manufacturer, which was a soap factory. Hialeah was incorporated a year later in 1925. And due to segregation laws, these Black workers couldn't live in the area. So James Bright, one of the co-founders of Hialeah, provided this plot of land for them, and that became Seminola. One of Hialeah's first Black settlers was Ben Marshall, and according to the Dade Heritage Trust, he was actually Bright's right-hand worker. And while looking into the community, Sherry and I stumbled upon a post on Instagram, actually, about Seminola. Like, this is how we found out about the neighborhood. And we found out through the comments on that post that some of Marshall's family members, 100 years later, still live in Seminola, which I feel is like so rare these days. So we, of course, want to speak to the family.
And to that point, Helen, you spoke with a gentleman, Gerald Dennis, who's the great-grandson of one of Seminola's original settlers, and he's become basically a prime historian for Seminola, right?
Yeah, so we spoke to Gerald Dennis. He's the great-grandson of Ben Marshall, and he and his family have been kind of on a mission to preserve not only Ben Marshall's story, but the Seminola history as it is part of Hialeah's overall history. Jarrell, as I mentioned, still lives in Seminola. He lives in the home that his grandfather, Steve Marshall, the son of Ben Marshall, purchased decades ago. And we met him and the family back in January. They welcomed us into their home. And for hours that morning. We talked about their history, how they felt growing up in the neighborhood, what it was like back then and what it's like now. And I wish some of that tape could have made it to our final piece, but it was really beautiful to see how important preserving that history is for this family. And it was just great to learn about the Marshalls and the impact they've made in this community.
Speaking of your reporting, a big part of your story is about how Seminola didn't get included in Hialeah's centennial celebration. I want to play a clip from Ben Marshall's granddaughter, Bertha Marshall Chavis.
I don't want our legacy to die. I didn't attend the ceremony that they did at my land apartment. I was angry, the mayor. And here I was, you know, calling, going, you know, attending the few meetings that he actually set on. And he just was so like, yes, we're going to do this. Yes, okay, it's a go, this and that. But when the actual day came, I was pissed.
So Sherry, Helen, let me ask each of you, as South Florida millennials and Gen Zers, what's the most important thing you took away and that you hope your listeners and readers will take away from your exploration of these slices of relatively unknown local history? Sherry?
What I took away from both of these stories is that Hialeah has such an interesting and pretty incredible history, a lot of which Helen and I weren't even able to get into with our stories. I grew up very close to Hialeah in the West Little River area and didn't even know until a year ago, really, that there are flamingos at the Hialeah racetrack, which I wish I would have known when I was younger, growing up there. So I just hope that people who read or listen to our stories feel encouraged to learn more about their neighborhood or city, and that they maybe even take on the important work of preserving their local history.
Helen?
Yeah, and like Josh, I grew up in Miami-Dade County my entire life, and Sherry. And I personally didn't know about Seminola or the racetrack even, I'll be honest. I don't know. I grew up in Little Havana. So reporting this history, I found out so much about Hialeah and just in general Miami's history. And I think, you know, every moment I think I know everything about this place, I learned something new and I'm like, okay, I'm humbled and surprised. Mm-hmm. But I hope listeners do the same. I hope they continue to be curious and ask questions about their cities and counties' history. And I also think it's important to acknowledge communities that help build the institutions that we know and love today. I mean, we heard from Bertha Marshall Chavis. She was very upset, you know, without the black workers from Seminola, we wouldn't have the Hialeah racetrack or many places in Hialeah and the rest of the county, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to continue to preserve that history, continue to tell these stories, and continue to be curious.
Helen Acevedo is WLRN's afternoon anchor. Sherilyn Cabrera is our senior producer. Joshua Ceballos and I will be right back with more discussion of WLRN's series, History We Call Home. Still to come, the Bahamians who built the Venetian Pool and the school that helped create Davy. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're devoting today's holiday program to a look at WLRN's fascinating series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida, about the raft of local centennials we're celebrating in 2025 and 2026, a century after the region's epic land boom sparked a boom of city charters. In our last segment, we discussed Hialeah history. Now we want to turn to Coral Gables, especially the folks who built the city's iconic Venetian Pool, and Davy, a Broward town that too often gets overlooked in South Florida lore. With me again is WLRN's government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos, who has headed the History We Call Home series. And also with us in the studio is the South Florida Roundup's producer, WLRN's Jimena Romero, and our education reporter, Natalie LaRoche-Pietri. Jimena, Natalie, how are you?
Good, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Jimena, your History We Call Home report examined one of the beautiful showcases that makes Coral Gables the so-called city beautiful, and that's the Venetian Pool, which today is on the National Register of Historic Places. But you gleaned something about the creation of the Venetian pool that a lot of folks know little, if anything, about. And that's the Bahamians who built it. Tell us why they were the artisans who created this South Florida landmark.
Yeah. Well, back in the 1900s, Miami had a large population of Bahamians because many farmers traveled seasonally to South Florida, mainly to work in agriculture, but right. also construction. In fact, many developers and entrepreneurs in the region would advertise their projects in Bahamian newspapers to attract them.
Newspapers in the Bahamas?
Uh-huh, exactly.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. Exactly. And they did this because of their skill and craftsmanship. Many of the early pioneers that came to South Florida from northern states knew how to use lumber, for example.
Right, but and we should point out that the Bahamians didn't just build a Venetian pool. They were really the original builders of Miami.
Exactly, yeah, right. The Venetian pool is central to the creation of the city. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you know, Miami and other parts of our region, for sure. So they would advertise to them because of their skill and craftsmanship in knowing how to use materials that are native to South Florida. Like I said, pioneers of the region that would come from other states knew how to use lumber, for example, but not necessarily a coral rock or oolitic limestone.
That's
which is
a
the
great
actually,
point.
Right. So so they would come in and they had these skills and they would teach these pioneers. And of course, they quarried the coral rock to build the homes and structures in Coral Gables. The entrances that are so popular to the city, they're built from that material, for example. And after quarrying all that material, there was a huge pit that they left behind. And that was the Venetian pool.
Fascinating.
And Ximena, one of the other interesting aspects of your report is how Coral Gables then used the Venetian pool as an anchor for the city's new development. How did it end up being a major lure, not just for entertainment, but also real estate growth?
Right. So the pool itself opened in 1924 and was initially called Venetian Casino.
Ah.
So this was even before the city was incorporated in 1925. And they had all kinds of entertainment events or aspects there. Like they had beauty pageants there. And they also had, for example, sometimes they would empty the pool and they would make a makeshift amphitheater where the orchestra will be playing at the bottom of the pool. Like it became kind of like an entertainment venue more than, like even more than just going into the pool and bathing there. And it was designed like that because they would use those entertainment performances or entertainment events to lure people so that then later would buy properties in the area. Mm-hmm. And it was very successful.
Yeah. Natalie, your History We Call Home report on the founding and history of Davie also features a landmark that played a central role in the city's origin. And fittingly enough, because you're WLRN's education reporter, that landmark was a school, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
It is one of Broward County's earliest school buildings that is still standing today, and it's a historical landmark protected federally now.
Really?
It's also known as a very haunted place. So Carlton Gillespie actually did a story on it earlier this year about paranormal activity or supposed paranormal activity in the
school. Do we know who the ghosts are who are haunting it?
Probably some of the pioneers that came down in the early 1920s and started building the community, because this school was really at the heart of the community that was developing and the families that it was attracting at the time.
Huh. And Natalie, you also cite Davie as being originally an almost frontier sort of town in the heart of the Everglades. And as Tim sort of alluded to earlier, it often gets forgotten in South Florida lore. Davie is known for horses and rodeos, very frontier energy. How does that historical character feature in Davie, both in this time in the 1920s and now in a century later?
So right now, when you drive through Davie, it's still a very prominent feature of the culture there. Like, a lot of the architecture is very rodeo-esque, and some of the houses that aren't in gated communities but are just like private property, the mailboxes will be like a rearing horse, and then the mailbox is like the head of the horse or coming out of its mouth. So it's very much still prominent. And back then it was also a
enjoyed by the town to go to the rodeo and to also ride horses, but from my understanding, it's something that developed more strongly over the years.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. WLRN's Joshua Ceballos and I are speaking with the station's journalist about their reports for the series History We Call Home and the slew of city centennials we're seeing today. Right now, we're talking with Jimena Romero and Natalie LaRoche-Pietri about their centennial histories of Coral Gables and Davie. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Jimena, I want to ask you a sort of larger picture question here, because you're not originally from South Florida. You're from Mexico, specifically Mexico City. I lived there myself for many years, and so I know what a long and rich history it has. South Florida, on the other hand, has, by comparison, a shorter sense of history, let's say. So as an immigrant to South Florida from a place like Mexico, what did working on History We Call Home teach you about the importance of history for a young city like Coral Gables, the city where you in fact now live?
Right, yeah. No, like you said, if you compare, you know, the history down here than what you, you know, the history that you know about in Mexico City, of course, there's a big difference, especially of how it's been recorded, no? And you can go to museums and understand it, and there's all these resources available, right? But sure enough, when I came in here, I was not aware of the history in the city that I live in the cities adjacent to where I live in. I went to high school here, and we never went over that as part of the curriculum. But I have to say that working on my stories for History We Call Home, and even reading and listening the work of my colleagues, you come to realize that, you know, South Florida and in our state, really, it has a really, really rich history that it's like people don't speak about it enough. Mm-hmm. Or you know, teach it to anyone enough. So I think we're just not aware of it.
Right. And I should point out that recent archaeological findings in places like Brickell in Miami have pointed out to us that we do have a very rich pre-Columbian indigenous history here, just the way that Mexicans, for example, discovered their indigenous history much more richly with the archaeological digs in the Zocalo in Mexico City, for example. Yeah.
And Natalie, I want to pose the same sort of question to you in a different way. You've lived in South Florida longer, Broward County specifically, but like Jimena and I, you're part of a younger generation. What did your historical reporting on a Broward city like Davie teach you about the importance for younger South Floridians about knowing the history of the region that them and their families came to, like your family did from Venezuela?
Well, I not only grew up in Broward, but I grew up really close to Davie. So a lot of my childhood was spent in Davie or really near Davie, and a lot of my best friends live there today. I think that at the heart of it, because I was reporting on a school, it was just a big reminder of the importance of education to a community, and just the sense of being in a shared space through your childhood and then even adult life, to still keep driving by that building and being reminded of your childhood memories. And it gives you a bigger sense of belonging. And you take trips down memory lane really often because it's just a reminder that's there in front of you on your commute to work or when you go to Publix or whatever.
Yeah. And Natalie, was there one person in your historical conversations with folks in Davie that stood out for you in your reporting who maybe in the aftermath sort of stays with you now as a connection to that place?
Yeah, I think the education director, Kim Wisemantle, really stands out to me because the way that she spoke about the building and not just the
and
building.
And remind us the name of that school now?
It is the old Davie Schoolhouse now, and it's also an event venue. Mm-hmm. But Kim spoke about the school and its history in such a caring and loving way, and she is so dedicated to preserving the history and also to continue to learn more about it as she uncovers new documents and hears anecdotes from people, from new people that she meets that, you know, hadn't shared their stories before. And her mission to make sure that all histories in Davie, the history of segregation in schools, the history of when Indigenous people were displaced in the area before Davie was developed, is also represented and told in full in the school.
Yeah, and along those lines, I also want to listen to a 1991 clip that's in your report from the late Davie school teacher Edna Hammer Griffin, who came to the city in 1927, talking about one of her favorite Davie school teachers, Althea Jenny.
Everyone loved Miss Jenny. She had been at Davie School around 35 years. She had always said she was going to teach until I came back from college and took her place, and it happened that way. She retired in 1946. I graduated from college, from FSU, which was Florida State College for Women at that time, in 1946, and in the fall, I started teaching at Davie Elementary School. I took Mrs. Jenny's second grade.
Yeah, that's the sort of historical continuity that builds communities that we don't often notice.
As well, I would also say that to me, the building itself was a character. Walking through the classrooms with the original wood floors and some of the original blackboards where you can still see the writing. It says writing, arithmetic, and reading. Mm-hmm. You just
The three R's.
Yeah. You just get the sense that it was so beloved by so many people throughout the years. And it's really in the walls. The school was built in 1918. Mm-hmm. It opened with about 90 students. In 1925, Davie gets incorporated into Broward County for the first time. And by the late 1970s, there were too many kids for the school to hold, essentially. So In 1978, they opened the new Davie Elementary, which is where the Mustangs are now. That's their mascot. And you can just feel that pride in where they've been and where their origins are and who they are now and how they want to keep equipping the generation of today to be the bright leaders of tomorrow. I don't think that mission has ended, and you can feel it.
But as you mentioned, that original school is a historic site now.
Yes, it is. One of the parts of the tour is you stop at this showcase, essentially, of toys that the kids would play with in 1918 and the early 1920s. Uh-huh. And it's a lot of the same things that you still see today. The box of crayons, the mm-hmm. yo-yos, the dolls.
Really?
Yeah. And Kim has this moment where she's showing you those things and you're seeing the photos of the kids and they're in black and white. And she tells you, kids are just kids and they'll keep being kids. I think that's one of the biggest through lines of the story is how much a place can change and still the heart of it be so similar through so many generations.
And Ximena, quickly back to you. How about you and Coral Gables? Was there anyone in particular in the Bahamian community that played a central role in your reporting?
Yeah, that's Carleon Prime, who is himself of Bahamian descent and president of the Lola B. Walker Homeowners Association. He lives in the McFarland subdivision, which is one of the neighborhoods where Bahamian immigrants settled and they actually built their homes there. He lives in the house that his grandfather built. And now he's retired now. Now he all he does in his free time is, trying to preserve the history. He's working to preserve the original houses that Bahamian workers built originally back then. And I went to his backyard and he told me the history of his house and his family through avocado trees. It was the avocado tree that his grandfather planted. Then next to it was the avocado tree that his father planted. And then right next to it was the avocado tree that he planted. And that just tells you why it's so important to keep this history alive in this neighborhood.
That's so lovely. And here's a little bit of that Carleon Prime, what he had to say about that in your report.
As we just move along, still trying to keep that spirit of community. And not lose it, and as long as there's some of us who are alive who can preserve it, we'll do it, and we'll try to find a way to make sure that the next generation understands it and that it's not lost.
Jimena, that story that you told of the avocado trees, I found so beautiful because of the generations just physically represented there. And as we were just talking, you're from Mexico, I'm from Venezuela. One of the things that this project taught me as well is that we don't have that sort of continuous history because we have it in another country. You know, we don't have that access point like we are able to dive into in these stories for history we call home. So for me, it was also just really rewarding and beautiful to be able to, even though it's not the history that I was born into, it's the history that I grew up with as well, and have just, like, it's been a joy to dive into.
I think that sums it up. Natalie LaRoche-Pietri is WLRN's education reporter. WLRN's Jimena Romero is the South Florida Roundup's producer. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
And our government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos, heads up the WLRN series, History We Call Home. Josh, many thanks and congrats on this fascinating project.
My pleasure, Tim.
Still to come, History We Call Home looks at Pearl City, the Freedom Tower, and Al Capone's rum running through Deerfield Beach. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're looking back today at WLRN's fascinating series called History We Call Home, about the slew of city centennials being celebrated across South Florida in 2025 and 2026. From Coral Gables and the Bahamians who built the iconic Venetian Pool, to Jupiter and its pioneering role as a maritime life-saving station, these reports remind us how much of this subtropical region took shape back in the mid-1920s, when the great real estate boom of that decade spawned municipal charters up and down the coast. Back on July 25th, we spoke with three of the WLRN reporters who brought us these histories. Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus told us about Boca Raton's historic black neighborhood, Pearl City. Morning Edition producer Amy Galliano, who at that time was Amy Sanchez, joined us to talk about the saga of Miami's iconic downtown Freedom Tower. And Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie filled us in on Deerfield Beach's journey from Al Capone haunt to Broward boomtown. Wilkin Brutus, I want to start with you and your deep dive into one of South Florida's most interesting black communities, the Pearl City neighborhood of Boca Raton. When we talk about black migration a century ago, we usually think of south to north, from states like Georgia to cities like Chicago, for example. You point out that Boca Raton actually benefited from a north to south black migration from states like Georgia to Pearl City. Tell us how that played out and how important Pearl City became to the city Boca Raton eventually became.
Yes, it's certainly a story that isn't told often. The Pearl City neighborhood, which was established in 1915, about a decade before Boca Raton's incorporation, was built to house black farm workers who were quite essential to the booming farming industry mm-hmm. in early Boca Raton. And so this was part of a wave of black, white, and even Japanese folks who migrated to the area in the late 19th and early 20th centuries for better pay in farming. Mm-hmm. And so Pearl City had its own black family-run businesses because it had to during the Jim Crow era.
Right. And Pearl City, though, I mean, I gather from your report very vividly that Pearl City, you know, wasn't just an important historic black community. It was an important community in terms of developing Boca Raton itself, no?
Oh, absolutely. Some of the stories itself describes folks who had spent time in the military.
Right.
There was a military base. Black folks were very much involved in that. The community itself had juke joints and restaurants and grocery stores. Definitely part of the early development of Boca Raton. So you can't really describe the early parts of Boca Raton without Pearl City, primarily right. because of its early influences.
Now, of course, Pearl City's residents had to face the harsh realities of segregation. And I want to play a clip here of a woman you interviewed, Marie Hester, who remembers those days.
Like, you can't go to this place or that place. Blacks have to go through the back door. When you go to the grocery store, make sure just to drink out of the black water fountain. I was never told why either. Most of the pioneers did not tell you why. They just would say, you do what I tell you to do.
and this could save your life.
Wilkin, just briefly, tell us about Pearl City today, a century after it overcame those Jim Crow days in South Florida.
I want to say Maria Hester's mom is 96 years old, so it was an absolute pleasure speaking with these women who are in their 70s and 80s. And so while some descendants like Maria Hester have returned and remodeled their ancestral homes, typical migration patterns, gradual integration and gentrification led many Black residents to move away. But the neighborhood's legacy lives on through its remaining two historic churches, many preserved homes, and community spirit, because, you know, Boca economy is now driven by finance, tech, and healthcare rather than farming. Mm-hmm. And so the neighborhood still has its community spirit because there's all sorts of events catering towards Pearl City.
Amy, you gave us a compelling centennial history of the Freedom Tower in downtown Miami. Walk us briefly through what the Freedom Tower originally was and the inspiring Miami Statue of Liberty, as one source calls it, that it later became.
Yeah, so the Freedom Tower first opened in 1925, and it served as the headquarters for the newspaper, the Miami Daily News and Metropolis. Mm-hmm. But then that newspaper moved out 3 decades later, and essentially the tower was left without an owner and really without purpose. But then the federal government in 1962 turned the tower, or the building at that time, into a processing center.
And it became a processing center because of...
It became a processing center because of the hundreds of thousands of Cubans that were fleeing the communist revolution. And so at that processing center, they received financial aid and food, medical care. And they also found out about different job opportunities that they were also offering.
Now, you, of course, had some moving interviews with people, particularly Cubans escaping communism back in Cuba, about their transit through Freedom Tower to a new and more hopeful life in Miami and America. And one of them was Luis Serrano, who described to you how he just barely made it out back in 1967.
I was born in the city of Camagüey, which is towards the east of Cuba, where the big belly of the island is. I'm the son of a housewife and a doctor, so we had a comfortable life. In the summer, between 8th and 9th grade, during my vacation, we received the notification that we were going to be allowed to leave Cuba, and I left Cuba in August 30th of 1967. Cuba had a policy, the communist government had a policy, that if a male was between the ages of 15 and 27, they could not leave the country because that was considered military age. And so if we had not left when we did, when I was 14 and a half years old, we would have had to stay in Cuba because they would not have allowed me to leave.
Amy, what was your sense then of what the Freedom Tower means to people in Miami like Luis Serrano?
Honestly, a lot from what I gathered from people that I spoke with, it's just that the Freedom Tower means exactly what the name says. It means freedom for them.
Yeah.
It was this opportunity to be able to come to a new place and build a life that they didn't see for themselves in Cuba. And so it speaks a little bit about their bravery and their courage for coming to a new place. And that's something that Luis mentioned as well when I was speaking with him. He said that he loved the fact that they treated him so well when he came, because you don't know what can happen when you take the risk and you go to another country to start a new life. And so I think for people that I spoke with, it means hope and freedom and this chance at a better and new life.
Right. Miami Statue of Liberty. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Wilkin Brutus, Amy Galliano, and Carlton Gillespie about their reports for our series, History We Call Home. They're telling us about the centennials of Boca Raton, Miami's Freedom Tower, and Deerfield Beach. Carlton Gillespie, I was, of course, taken by your history of Deerfield Beach, not least of which because it has an Al Capone connection. I want to play a clip here from your interview with Jeff Fisk, a member of the Deerfield Beach Historical Society, who sort of sums up why the iconic gangster Capone ditched Miami and came north to Broward.
He was getting harassed so much in Miami that as soon as he would cross into the city limits, if a police car saw his vehicle, they would pull him over. They would make up something. He was getting pretty hot down there, so he was looking for a place that no one would bother him.
And Carlton, you report that a lot of that also had to do with the role the Hillsborough River played in the rum-running days of Prohibition a century ago. Tell us more about that.
Right. The Hillsborough River was dredged out by the Army Corps of Engineers into, and it happened to a number of these kind of inland rivers down in South Florida, but it was dredged in a straight line almost all the way to the Okeechobee Canal. So
yeah,
it was easy to kind of float something down the river and transport it out. And Capone specifically, it's like a movie scene. He had a fish packing house right on the mouth of the river, right where the Intracoastal is. They would put the booze put the false bottom on top, cover it with dry ice, pack it with fish, and send it off either to the railroad in the center of town in Deerfield or up the river to ship it out. There was a ton of rum running in the operation, area.
Your fish would have mercury and cane alcohol.
Right, yeah. And, you know, there was a famous restaurant in nearby, what's now nearby Lighthouse Point, called Cap's Place, that opened in 1928. And Cap Knight, the owner, was a notorious law flouter and rum runner. And there would be just barrels they'd mark barrels and float them up the river. And then, they'd get picked up and the cash would get dropped at a later date. I mean, it was prevalent in this part of the county. It was really a lot of fun to uncover.
But obviously, Deerfield Beach has moved beyond that portrait of itself from Prohibition to the modern and developed Broward County showcase it is today. But do folks there still embrace that colorful history to some extent?
You know, there was in Capone's old fish packing house, it was replaced with a place called the Riverview Restaurant. And that restaurant had some of the old gambling paraphernalia that was left behind by Capone kind of up on the walls until it was shut down. But no, I think in general, they don't. I mean, I'm from Northern Broward and I knew none of this. In fact, this whole story got kicked off. I was driving a couple of friends down Hillsborough Boulevard, and I pointed out the Butler House and said, I'm way behind the eight ball in this story. I've got to do something. And they said, we got to call your friend County. And my friend County Price, turns out he's the great, great, great grandson of George Emery Butler, the town's first mayor.
Right.
I had no idea.
Right.
So that certainly made sourcing a lot easier. But I think people just kind of don't realize the history that's beneath their feet.
Right.
A lot of times. That's why I think the series is so great.
Which brings me to the last question I want to ask all three of you. How this WLRN History We Call Home series perhaps gave you guys, yourselves, a greater appreciation of the history that exists here in a region that frankly has a reputation for not having much history. Wilkin?
Yeah, you know, WLRN listeners throughout the years have engaged with many of my profiles about ethnic enclaves, whether it's the Hungarians or Finnish or indigenous Guatemalans, in this case, Black Americans in Pearl City. And so these stories about human migration and community often get swept under our historical lens. And so History We Call Home helps to reintroduce those voices beyond the Florida man tropes.
Yeah, I mean, you Wilkin, you also reported on Jupiter and how lighthouses, for example, you know, really helped make South Florida, you know, not just an outlier or backwater, but an urban center.
Absolutely. You can't talk about Palm Beach County's history without its lighthouse. And so it also reintroduces folks in South Florida about the various histories within South Florida itself.
Amy, what about you?
Absolutely. It makes me have a greater appreciation because I myself took pictures at the Freedom Tower when I was a little girl, and I didn't know the history that I was basically standing in front of. And so it was really cool to also find out about
that. Yeah, and tell us about your own personal family history.
I'm Brazilian, but my parents are Ecuadorian, and so I came here to the U.S. to live here when I was 9 years old. And so that's when I went and I took a picture at the Freedom Tower in front of Bayside. And it was really cool to be able to learn about the place that I now call home.
Right. Carlton.
Well, there are, I push back. I would say there are people that are dedicated in preserving this history. We heard from Jeff Fisk earlier for my story. I mean, there are people out there who want to leave these things intact and protected. And I want to echo something Timothy Butler said in my story. He said, of his late grandfather, he always told me, you're going to want to ask us more questions because when I'm gone, there's going to be nobody else who remembers. So that's what I would encourage people to do in their communities and keep this history alive.
But let me ask you just real quickly then in 10 seconds here. Again, do Deerfield Beach people, maybe perhaps as a result of your report, suddenly see a history that they never knew before?
That's certainly the response I've gotten from people. I mean, plenty of people have said, oh, I had no idea this was going on. I grew up on this street. I mean, it's been a great response.
That was WLRN's Carlton Gillespie, Amy Galliano, and Wilkin Brutus discussing the centennials of Deerfield Beach, Miami's Freedom Tower, and Boca Raton's Pearl City. Finally on the roundup, The centennial celebrations of South Florida cities are certainly not over, nor is our series highlighting the rich histories behind them. In 2026, a handful of more cities will be marking their 100th birthdays. The City of North Miami Centennial is coming up on February 5th, marking 100 years since developers Earl Irons and Arthur Griffin voted to incorporate it as the town of Miami Shores, not to be confused with the Village of Miami Shores. North Miami, by the way, will celebrate with a carnival that day. Opa-locka, which was the vision of aviation pioneer Glenn Curtis, will turn a century old on May 14th. It was chartered as a town in 1926 by only 28 registered voters. Also built by Curtis, Miami Springs will have its 100th birthday on August 23rd. The city is counting down the days on its website to kick off a series of centennial events. Miami Springs is shining a spotlight on its founder, who was at one time known as the fastest man on earth after beating the land speed record on his custom motorcycle. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.